Welcome to another episode of the Gay Barchive Show, where we explore gay history one bar at a time. I'm your host, Art Smith, and our guest today is Doug Probst, perhaps better known as Sean Maya, street hustler from Southern California in the 1980s and 90s. Doug has recently released a book called Mayot, The Musings of a Narcissist, and he's going to tell us about some of his favorite bars from the Long Beach, California area. Well, welcome to the show, Doug.
Hi, Art.
How you doing?
I'm doing good. Good. Early in the morning. Got my cup of coffee.
Me too.
Yeah.
I'm really looking forward. We're going to talk about one segment of your gay experiences in Southern California, which, of course, is the Long Beach chapter. As I understand it, that was the first exposure you had to a gay environment after getting out of your incarceration of sorts. So why don't we talk about that? What was it like when you were released? You were, what, 17 years old, and you landed in Long Beach, California?
It was wonderful. Let me tell you that, and I'll backtrack a little bit, because it was my first experience with gay being accepted and then being around gay people on my own terms. In other words, as you know, as you read the book, while I was incarcerated, everything was done to me, so I didn't have a choice. But being down there in Long Beach, I gotta say, the memories are so clear. Even though they're 37 years ago, it was the greatest time of my life. I was free. And I was able to walk among people that were safe. And I don't know how I found out about Broadway. I can't even tell you how I knew about it. But I got down to Broadway, and everybody I came across was either nice, gay. It was a great time. It was a great time. It was.
So you're relocated to Long Beach. You basically had a few bucks in your pocket they gave you to get through the next couple of days.
Yep.
Didn't know anybody.
Nope.
And you were there on the boulevard.
Yep. I ended up on Broadway, walking down Broadway. And Broadway at that time, Long Beach, okay, let's put it this way. Long Beach was like New York. It had the old buildings. Maybe not as old, in New York, 200 years, maybe Long Beach was 150 years, but they were old and falling apart. Everything in downtown Long Beach was falling apart. It was old, but for me, it was, there's beauty in decay. It was incredible. I got to see all kinds of things I'd never seen before. In that area, there were so many bars and so many, the Navy was there. So there was a lot of Navy bars, people fighting in the streets. And for me, it was a spectacle. Long Beach was a cosmopolitan town, but it was also a city that everybody around the world visited. It was one of those cities that, like Miami, you go to experience all the fun things in Long Beach. The Pike was still there. And that was dangerous. That was very dangerous down there. So I didn't fear anything, although I should have, because there was crime all around. But for some reason, either guardian angel or whatever you want to call it, I just bulldozed my way through. And the first day I was on Broadway, I met a man named Alan Bellinger who, told me, "I'll give you $500 if you let me suck your dick." And I said, "You're going to give me $500 to suck my dick." And I said, "Should it be the other way around?" And he goes, no, I want to do it. And we went into an alley and he did it. I said, "Show me the $500 first." And that was my start of my hustling career. That was how it started. I was like amazed. I was like, I made $500 the first day and I didn't really have to do anything except enjoy it. And then as I kept walking down Broadway, I ran into friends that were in boys' homes with me. And they told me about some of the bars. They told me about Ripples. They told me about Paradise. They knew I was a piano player. But the one bar that made the biggest impression on me as I walked down Broadway was Little Lucy's. I'll never forget. I mean, I have a real big fondness. I have an erection in my heart for Little Lucy's. That was a transgender bar. And outside that bar, it was on Broadway in Orange. And outside that bar, they noticed me. I mean, it's hard. I realize now, you know, back then, you know, I was at the right time in the right place, you know, blonde hair, Chris Atkins kind of look, only a longer surfer hair. And I'd walk down there and I was buff. I had a little, you know, I did some working out when I was inside. And they all yelled at me from Little Lucy's, hey, cutie, come here. And I felt so welcomed. I walked over. And even at 17, they let me in the bar. And I made a ton of friends there. Just incredible, wonderfully sweet, nice, mostly transgender people. And since I didn't have a place to stay, they allowed me to sleep on their couches until, you know, I was able to make enough money through hustling to get my own apartment.
Now, physically, what was that bar like? Was it a big bar or a small bar? What was it? Little Lucy's.
Yeah, Little Lucy's was small. Now, you can't even find pictures of it if you look it up. It does say, if you Google it, it was one of the very first bars ever in 1966 it opened. But it was next to a 7-Eleven right there on Broadway and Orange. And I would say it was small. It wasn't like some of the much larger bars like Numbers in LA.
Right.
You know, Mickey's or something.
It wasn't a big dance club. It was more of a neighborhood.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, way better description than I gave. Yeah, it was a neighborhood bar.
Did you work that bar much? Did you pick up tricks there or, you know, make much money? Or was that kind of a refuge for you to, you know, hang out and have a safe space?
Great question. You know, I worked every friggin' bar. I worked the bushes. I worked wherever I was. I had no money. And I did pick up one thing from my father, from my piece of shit that was good. I wouldn't spend a dollar on anything. I was so afraid because I didn't have a job. So, you know, within a few months, I had $30,000. But to answer your question about Numbers, that's a great word you use, refuge. It was a refuge. Yes. Those guys stuck up for me. I mean, because Long Beach still isn't safe. It's like New York. It has that element. I mean, I saw there in my book, my editor took out a crime because the guy that did it was a friend of mine and I was with him. I didn't know he was going to do it, but those things happen a lot in Long Beach and it's still that way down in Long Beach. But those guys in that Little Lucy's, thanks for my long-winded answer, is exactly what you said. That was my refuge. It was a refuge. Yeah.
And the murder story doesn't totally surprise me. In the course of my research, you know, I've uncovered some 1,500 plus gay bars across the country that don't exist anymore. And there's probably at least a dozen or more that have some sort of a murder story associated with them, very often from within the community. Very often a gay on gay murder, a hustler that was wronged by, you know, a trick, a bar owner who was killed by an employee. There's a lot of them. But so it doesn't surprise me that there was a story like that connected to Little Lucy's as well.
Yeah, I had a couple friends that were murdered, a couple that were murdered just because they were gay. One that died right there on the street in front of me. It was horrible. You know, a Marine beat him to death. You know, the Marines and the Navy were right there in Long Beach, and they were clashing. They were fighting all the time, you know, with us trying to just have fun. But you're right about there was a lot of gay on gay crime, and a lot of that had to do with the drugs. It had to do with the meth. You'd have meth dealers dealing meth, and then, of course, you know, you take meth and you go crazy. And all of a sudden, you know, you're out to get everybody. You're paranoid and you're out to get everybody. And so I lost a few friends that way. I also had a friend, as you read in the book, who had battery acid thrown in his face by gay haters, you know, the haters, just before he went into the bar. And that was a horrible, one horrible thing that I'll never forget, Randy. And he died not too long after that. But you're right. There was a lot of gay on gay crime. And who knows what some of it was about. I mean, you're right. Some of it was hustlers being pissed off, not getting what they should have felt they should have got. There was also Randy Kraft. Do you remember? Do you know that name?
I do.
he passed by a few times on Broadway. And I just had an instinct. I don't know what it was, but I told the guys, don't get in that car. That guy is scary. And of course, now we know he's responsible for 66 murders, you know, emasculation of a lot of guys. And I did lose a couple that got into his car. So, you know, he had gay serial killers down there too, William Bonin. Those were those years.
Yeah, just to put it in perspective for everybody that's listening, in case they weren't paying attention, we're talking about the early 80s here. We're not talking about the 40s or the 60s. We're talking about something that is, you know, not that far in the distant past. It was, you know, 81, 82, somewhere around there. And so
Randy Kraft got busted in 83. They found him drunk driving, and he was swerving across the freeway. That's the only way. And he had a dead guy in his passenger seat. So, yeah, up to about 83, 84, yeah, it was a different time, right?
Now, in addition to your passion for Little Lucy's, there's some other bars there in that same general area that you were also pretty fond of and that you worked pretty regularly. Why don't we talk about some of those?
There was Paradise, like I said. They let me play the piano. I was a piano player. I was born piano player. And they would let me in and play the piano. I'd meet all kinds of – Paradise was more upscale. And it was on the corner of Broadway, I think, in Hermosa. They're all, like, right there. It's very, very, entrenched, kind of like a – I don't know. You know, they're, it's very condensed. Also, another one – that I really loved was Silver Fox over on 4th and Redondo. That was a classy gay bar where there was a lot of wealthy men, and I'd come in there or I'd be invited in there by John. I don't like to call people Johns or Trip because they were my friends. They were my friends, and you know, surrogate fathers. I mean, they really cared about me. So I'd go to Silver Fox. Silver Fox played a big, yeah, that was a big one. That was a big one. Another would be Mineshaft. I didn't stay much in Mineshaft because when I went into Mineshaft, it was Cowboy Leather Bar, and I wasn't into that. I mean, they liked seeing me, but I knew some of the guys there. Didn't spend much time there. I'm trying to think of Ripples. Well, of course, there's the one. I mean, Ripples was the bar. I mean, if it's not the most famous gay bar in California, I don't know what it is. Maybe the Rail in San Francisco, but Ripples was famous, and Ripples was a lot of fun. I could go there and have fun and dance with my friends. It was also bisexual. There was a lot of women there. It was everything, and it was right on the beach. So I mean, you couldn't ask for anything better than Ripples. Ripples was nice too. The nice people were there. Now later, Ripples played a part in my life when it moved to a smaller place on, I think it's 2nd Street. And I was managing bands and I was managing singers, and I managed a band that had never, you know, played there before, had never been in London. And they went there, and you know, I'm not disparaging the band. I'm just saying that they didn't have gaydar. They didn't realize what they were going into. And so, you know, I was talked to on the side. I said, just, they're your fans. Play the best you can. And I had to fill in for them because some of the patrons asked for songs that they didn't know. But Ripples became more of a less of a dance bar and more of just a regular bar. But in the beginning, yes, you hit upon Ripples was the spot. That was the spot. Everybody went to Ripples.
Yeah, and Ripples was there for almost 40 years, I think. 40 years. 37 years or something.
Yep. Something like that.
And closed, what, like 4 or 5 years ago?
Yeah.
Finally.
But, how that could ever
Yeah, I made a post in my Facebook group the other day about Ripples, and I got people commenting from all over and sending me private messages. I remember there, you know, or one memory that came up a few times, somebody had said, well, there used to be a long line to get in, especially I think on Sundays. And a lot of times people would drive by and throw eggs and stuff at the people waiting in line, and a little bit of aggressive behavior from the anti-gay element back in the 80s at Ripples. Yep. But I've known about Ripples for a while. It was one of the early bars that I discovered in my research. And it certainly has a lot of memories for a lot of people.
It's probably it has the most memories of any bar that I can think of, because it was so popular. Also, you brought up something, you know, that we had to deal with then. You know, everything was, it seemed like, you know, even though I was a youngster in the 70s, my own research, everything was coming out in the 70s, and it was fantastic in the 70s. Once AIDS hit in the early 80s, you know, it gave fuel to old prejudices.
Right.
So not only were we dealing with people who hated gay people just because they hated gay, now we had AIDS on top of it, which gave them even more fuel to the fire to hate us, kill us, do whatever they wanted to. And nobody would talk back to them. Instead of the one thing that I always, because before there was even a name for the disease, as you know, I 30 of my friends died on the boulevard. There was no name. It was 1982. There wasn't even gay cancer until somebody told me, and they were dying left and right. And I didn't understand how anybody could not be compassionate and help these kids who were dying. I mean, and so, you know, that's a whole other conversation, but it's one that I really want to write about and talk about, because on the one hand, you know, it brought out a small number of the best in people, but it sure showed the worst in America.
It did. I remember, I would guess before like 1975, the gay community in general was kind of in the closet. Almost all the bars, almost all the activities were still kind of unknown to the general population.
Right.
I think what kind of broke that loose a little bit was in the mid 70s, we had the disco scene come out.
Right.
And disco, by the nature of the music and the people who liked it, kind of forced a blending of some minority groups, as well as the gays and some of the hip straight people in the drug scene or in the party scene. And suddenly you had big bars around the country that were attracting a mixture of these different people. So from the mid 70s to the early 80s, you started having the gay community become a little bit more visible, because straight people were going to bars that were predominantly gay and played a lot of disco music. And then, as you said, in the early 80s, AIDS hit, and all of a sudden, all these people who now have recent gay acquaintances are seeing them all have some kind of a strange disease that it's almost like leprosy. They're afraid they're going to catch it just by being in the same room. And it fueled a lot of antagonistic behavior from people who might have become allies of the community, because of the fear factor and the way the government was treating it at the time. So, and especially in areas like Southern California and New York, more so than the mid section of the country. So when you were working the streets out there, you were hustling and making the bucks. Because of the fact that you were in Southern California, you also encountered some celebrities who became patrons of yours somehow or other. They became acquaintances, friends, business partners of sorts. Who was the first celebrity that you stumbled across in your I don't even know what to call it, because, you know, these days hustling is even considered kind of not politically correct. As a sex worker, is that the correct term now? What was your first encounter?
I've been out of it for so long, but I can tell you that the very first one was a guy named Brian Tochi, who's an actor. And I'm sure he wouldn't mind me mentioning his name. He picked me up in a limousine. He was from the ad. A guy named John Movito, who was known as Robbie Leonetti in the gay adult film world, became my best friend, became my mentor, my big brother, and he helped me navigate my way through the perplexing world of escorting, because it was called escorting. And he said, put this ad in The Advocate. And I said, what the hell is The Advocate? It's the National Gay Men's Magazine. So I wrote this ad out, and oh my God, the first couple of weeks, I got hundreds of calls, and my income shot up, and I would meet people, and I had the ability, you know, to discern whether a guy was a flake or not. I mean, my ability to keep my head, a roof over my head, depended on it. I knew whether you were a flake or not. Brian Tochi was the first one. Now, if you look him up, he's been in a lot of movies. And he told me in the limousine, he said, don't define yourself by this. I got that a lot from a lot of the guys that I met, because they love my conversation. I was well-read. You know, when I got out of the system, I must have bought 15,000 books. That's everything. My whole place was books, music, everything. I wanted to make up for what I missed in the system. And I could hold my conversations. Now, when you talk about meeting celebrities, another one that I met early was Dak Rambo. And I didn't even know who the hell he was. I mean, I got a call from the ad. He called me and he said his name was Dak. I thought that was weird. And then we started talking. And what I noticed on the phone was a sweet, gentle, kind of cocky guy, but he was very naive. And we negotiated a price, and I drove up to, and I met him at Numbers. And the next thing I know, we're rolling around in bed, just joking and laughing. He was the sweetest guy and we became best friends. We became really good friends. He confided in me. I was really humbled and honored when his mother read my tribute to him on the AIDS Memorial. And she called and she was just, you know, it was wonderful. But, you know, he was gentle inside. Also, you know, when I went to Numbers, I met, you know, Sandy Gallen. They say if they're dead, don't say anything bad about them when they're dead. Okay, he's dead. Good. That guy was just unbelievable. I don't know what to say about him. But asshole, put it that way. I also met Alan Carr at Numbers. He was a sweet guy, but he was depressed at the time I met him because he had just done that weird, what was it? The opening to the Academy Awards, and it didn't come off well. And he was pissed off at everybody. And, you know, I did make my money with him and all that. Also Robert Reed. I met Robert Reed at a bar called Boulevard in Pasadena. Now I had no idea. I knew Pasadena very well. I eventually got a place in Pasadena after my son was born. His mother lived in Arcadia and he was with me half the time, her half the time. And I lived right on Colorado Boulevard. So I got to know how upscale Pasadena was at the time. And there were some bars, but at the time I met Robert Reed, he called on my ad. He called on the ad. Sometimes I mix them up, but Numbers in the ad. And I go to this Boulevard bar and I'm like, yeah, it's a gay bar in Pasadena. And Robert Reed is another one, you know, Mr. Brady. I'm sitting there looking at him. I'm going to have sex with Mr. Brady. This is cool. My father, kind of my father in the 70s, but he was a sweet guy. He was very, very, he wanted to keep everything undercover. He even offered me more money never to say anything about him. I wasn't going to do that anyway. I'm not out to hurt anybody. I don't believe in outing. I mean, it's your right, your business to tell people who you are and what you want people to know about yourself. And I knew tons of people who were not out, who I could have done all kinds of things. You know, I met my best friend of all was Michael Feilerman. I met him He's the producer. If you don't know, I know you know. If for people that don't know, he produced Knots Landing, 384 episodes. He wrote them and produced them. And he wrote Falcon Crest and he wrote Flamingo Road. He also wrote and produced Beverly Hills 90210 and Melrose Place, but they were stolen from him by Michael Chernin at Fox on the Fox network. And Michael told me he had to sue them to get it back. And he did win. He won the lawsuit. He wouldn't tell me how much money it was. It was over 10 million, but Michael was such an honorable man with integrity that he got out of the business. And we spent a lot of time together. I mean, we traveled the world. We traveled all kinds of places. We were like best friends. He met my son, Josh. I'd take Josh over to his house and Josh was, he's got 8 bedrooms, Daddy. And I always noticed, I always watched how wealthy people treated their help. And he was very generous and very sweet. And it was like, they were family too. God, I love Michael. It was so sad when he died. You know, he died of cancer in, I think 2014. And he bought the Coronet Theater on Melrose and La Cienega. And he would take me to all his shows. And he introduced me to a new actor named Noel Wiley and Peter Berg and all these people. And he was one that I loved. I really loved Michael. Michael was a father. There's also a couple non-famous people that I met. You know, they're famous in their own world, but I can't name their names. I don't want to name their real names because I still know the children. I was kind of a family gigolo to the whole family. I did the mother, the father. I'd get to their house, you know, and then end up in the bed with mom and dad and do my job and then come out and meet with the whole family in the morning. And they knew me like that. But at the same time, you know, mom and dad are dead and they probably inherited $500 million. And the last thing I need is for them they were a little embarrassed about their parents' sexuality and I don't need to be sued. Put it that way.
I respect that. I mean, you know, people like Robert Reed, everybody knows he's gay now.
Right.
That was not kept a secret his whole life. And so people know about that. And I agree. We don't necessarily want to go throw people under the bus that played a positive role in your life or that were, you know. Now, I know you had another celebrity encounter in your activism days because as a result of losing all these people with, friends with to AIDS, you kind of got very involved in the activism scene and working with different charities and things. And understand there is one very famous woman who is known for a lot of extravagant jewelry and multiple husbands. why don't you tell us about her a little bit?
My best friend. Oh, my God. It made me want to cry. Elizabeth Taylor. Yeah, I called her Liz because I didn't know. I was only 19. I really didn't know the extent of her fame. To me, she was like my parents. And oh, my God. When we got together at APLA, they would put people together for the buddy program where you take, you know, guys were dying left and right. So we would bag lunches, we'd bag food. We'd also bag their medicines and we'd go to the house together to the houses and just give them time and space to laugh and joke. Some of these men were blind and Elizabeth Taylor, she knew, I mean, she had to know who she was. But she acted like she was nobody. In other words, what I detected from her was that she knew acting was not as important as what she was doing for these men. And that was real. That was not an act. This was a woman who made jokes. I mean, funny jokes. I mean, she could have been a comedian. All the way to the house. We'd get to the house and they'd know Elizabeth Taylor was there and they'd light up. And Liz and I called her Liz and I got rebuked a lot of times. She's not Liz. She's Elizabeth. You don't call her Liz. And I was like, okay. All right. You know, she was my friend. But I have to say this. I have never met a more, I've met more celebrities, you know, if you call them celebrities, you know, especially music stars and rock stars and actors. I've never met a celebrity more down to earth and more real than Elizabeth Taylor. When in 1993, when she got her, I think she won an award, Matilda Krim, who was one of the first doctors who worked on AIDS, got up and spoke about Elizabeth. It was interesting because I always watch this kind of stuff. Everybody was clapping for Elizabeth at every joke every actor was making about her and that. But Matilda Krim got up and said, we could never have gotten this far with AIDS and helping people without Elizabeth's help. And not hardly anybody clapped. That's how hateful even straight people and even people in the business were to AIDS. But Elizabeth didn't show any, like, oh, I'm great, I'm this. It was just a smile. Like, yeah, that's what we're supposed to do. God, I loved her so much. I mean, I didn't know who she was when I first met her. They said, you're going to be paired up with Elizabeth Taylor. I'm like, okay, great. Who the hell is she? And by the time I was done, I started watching all her movies. And I can tell you from personal experience, this was one of the most wonderful people I ever encountered and spent a lot of time with. And I was so lucky and I'm grateful that I got the chance to. And I got the chance to deliver life-saving medications and foods to dying men with Elizabeth Taylor. Yes. And we stayed friends until she died. Yeah.
Yeah. In 1993, the award you were talking about was called the Jean Hersholt Humanitarian Award at the Oscars. The Academy Awards, she was nominated for the Jean Hersholt Humanitarian Award, and she won in 1993 for her work with AIDS. And for people who don't realize it, that are a little bit younger, maybe were not so aware in 1993, she was kind of, very much like the Princess Diana of the U.S. AIDS scene. She was the beautiful woman, you know, well, presented herself very well, very articulate, funny, very outgoing and friendly, and the face of, you know, an early face of the mainstream AIDS support group that we had back in, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s. So she really made an impact in addition to her film career and her fabulous collection of jewelry. Her AIDS work was, you know, remarkable.
Yeah, you made a very good comparison with Lady Di. I mean, I can see the reason, and it's always the reason. It's because they were genuine.
Yeah,
there was no pretense in either one of them. They weren't trying to do it to get, you know, to get fame. They weren't trying to do it, for any other reason except it was the right thing to do, and that's what makes somebody beautiful. I mean, I started my book because somewhat of the same reason. I wanted to just tell the truth, and I knew it was going to be fucking embarrassing because a lot of my friends never knew about that part of my life. I was that person who was telling everybody else, you've got to be out. You've got to be out if you want people to love you. And I'd stay in. And I worked at APLA for a long time with Matt Redman. And, I was all out in there. But as soon as I walked outside, you know, and then when I wrote the book, I said, fuck it. I got to tell everything. I'm going to tell everything as much as I can remember. And I think it's had that effect where people realize, you know, this guy's telling the truth. He was in that scene and he's telling on himself. I mean, there's no reason for me to tell on myself. It just gets me in more trouble. But I was nowhere near, you know, I wouldn't blame it on my upbringing or downbringing. Maybe some of that had to do with it, but I didn't have the integrity that Liz and Diana did. I mean, anyway, I've lost myself. Go ahead.
But I'm sure that experience kind of, you know, had a big impact on the development of your personality and your interaction with the gay community and who you are as a person today. And, you know, of course, that's always important. Now, you mentioned earlier that one of the celebrities who at the time was like America's father, Robert Reed. You met him in a bar in Pasadena called Boulevard?
Yeah, Boulevard.
So what was that bar like?
That was, you know, I didn't spend much time in there, but it was a classy bar. It was more of a, I don't know how to describe it. It was 90s. Wow, that was way back. No, that was in the 80s. It was a down-to-earth but classy bar, sort of like Robert Reed was. He was from the Midwest. He was from Oklahoma or Nebraska or something like that. And he was very gentle, he talked very, very, he was articulate and gentle, and he wanted to keep things secret. And that's kind of how the Boulevard was. It wasn't an out loud, you know, loud mouth bar. It wasn't a lot of dancing. It was just people meeting to have more like, you know, conversations. And there are tables and I was only there twice. So Boulevard doesn't stick in my mind as much, but I was surprised. I was surprised there was a gay bar in Pasadena. And then we drove to his house because he lived in Pasadena. And Pasadena, having lived in Pasadena since then because of my son, which also Elizabeth Taylor helped me with, you know, all those things that I did with my son, it was all about integrity with him, raising a baby and never getting mad. But when I lived in Pasadena because my ex-wife who had my son, in 1990, she lived in Arcadia, so I wanted to be right next door, and I basically had him 90% of the time, first 5 years of his life, and Pasadena is a very, very, it's cosmopolitan, but it's not gay. I mean, it's more business. They cleaned it up like crazy, so seeing a gay bar there, Boulevard, that was a little shocking. I was like, wow, there's a gay bar here. But it's a big, there's a gay bar everywhere. I wish I could give you a better description of Boulevard. I know it's still around. It's still there, so it's doing something right. But Pasadena does have a lot of money. And where there's money, there's gay. There's gay people. And I'm sure that nowadays Boulevard doesn't get hassled. It got hassled a lot by the cops in the 80s. I mean, when I was there with Robert Reed, the cops came in.
A lot of the bars, especially in bigger cities where they thought there was more of a gay problem.
Right.
A lot of times.
That's a gay problem, right.
The police often found ways to harass the clientele one way or another. I think it was more in the 80s than I think by the 90s it had passed. But some places in California had laws where two men couldn't dance together or touch each other in the bar, which I know existed from the 60s into the 80s in some places. And a lot of the times they would just look for a reason. In fact, a lot of cities even had what they called cross-dressing laws, which meant a man could not go out in full woman's attire at the time. So the drag queens would be harassed, or they'd have to wear, men's underwear under their dress and, things of that nature to have a certain number of male articles of clothing on. I don't know if that was a problem so much in the, Orange County area outside of LA or not.
It was the Garden Grove police shut down the Tiki Room. They raided those bars. They raided DOK till it shut down. All that. Yeah, it was really bad back then.
Now, were you ever harassed by the police in those cities? Were you ever taken downtown and busted for whatever they wanted to call it, soliciting or?
Yeah. Those are other stories. Another story I can tell you. I was also framed by the police one time. I got out of it because, it was a frame and it wasn't true. But, they got up on this, they lie, they do their thing. There's a lot of good cops, too. So a lot of good cops. But if you have, you know, 95% good cops and 5% cops kill people and write reports about it. I mean, I know about that too. I know about a couple people that then what are the good cops doing? I mean, you know, why aren't you stopping that? I suffered a frame up. Yeah, that's a whole nother story. And it turned me way against the cops for a while until I met other cops, because out on the boulevard, who really wanted to help me and really wanted to get me into rehab when I was doing drugs. So, you know, it's just like any other profession. There's good and bad. The only difference is that a police officer can write one thing in a report and send you to death row or send you anywhere and do whatever they want. And it could be a lie and change your life. Whereas other professions, they can't do that. And back then in the 80s, before Rodney King, and even Rodney King didn't change it. You know, there was no internet. There was no, you know, cell phone cameras. There was no body camera, nothing. We didn't realize. I did to a point, because I was also a musician playing in South Central with a lot of black musicians. And I had my Volkswagen bus ripped apart by police who thought I was buying drugs. And of course, you know, I made a lot of cracks that got me hit in the face by cops, but they did, it was nothing compared to when they pulled. I mean, I was with Billy Preston, and Billy Preston, they didn't give a shit who he was. And he was gay. God, I'm trying to remember the gay bars down in South Central. There were a couple of those too. The main bars were like Mavericks Flat on Stocker and Crenshaw. But I think the LAPD has really grown up. I mean, I don't understand hate in any form. I mean, you know, I never understood it. When I was a kid, I'd see 7-year-old boys, you know, put their arms around me in the bathroom. And they didn't know what they were feeling. They were gay. And they would say, "I love you, Doug. You're so pretty. And I'd love you to be my brother." And I think to myself, "No, you're gay. And you think I'm cute. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with it." I mean, I never have been offended at anything like that. It just, you know, where I have had friends that, "Now, let's go kill some fags."
Right.
I just don't get it. I just, you know. Flattery is wonderful, but you don't even have to flatter. It just doesn't make any sense. You know, my whole, and I've studied it for years because I want to come out with another book about it. The whole thing, the whole hatred towards gay people comes down to, it just looks weird to people. That's it. That's all it is. That's all that hate, all that hanging of gay people. I mean, when was the last time has a gay person hung a straight person for being straight? Never. When was the last time a gay person passed a law you can't be straight? Never. When was the last time gay people got together and raided straight bars? Never. You know, when was the last time? It's always straight people doing it to gay people. And they don't seem to get it because they want to justify it by some religious verse that isn't even real.
Right.
I'll give you one last thing that I say all the time. You know, you can safely assume that you've created God in your own image when God hates the same people you do. I mean, it's like, you know, I don't know what to say. It's just, it's mind boggling that I always thought when I was a kid that life would progress. And by this time we'd be on other planets and we'd be, you know, remember when the internet, remember before the internet came out, everybody was talking about how that was going to change the world and make humanity the better. Boy, were we wrong. I just hope things change in this new generation. My son, he's 31 now. And, you know, he's a liberal. His uncles are gay. He lives with my ex-partner. He works for him. And, you know, there are a lot of young people like that. That it doesn't mean shit. I don't
know.
There you go.
Yeah, and back, back in the days when you were, you know, working the strip in Long Beach, you were kind of the picture of, you know, wholesome America, even though you were in an occupation that would not have been accepted by a lot of people. Just right. Looking at you standing, you know, next to your Volkswagen bus with, you know, your shirt off, working out, wearing a tight pair of shorts, long blonde surfer hair. You were like the cover boy for every, you know, mainstream teen pop magazine that existed.
Yeah.
Just looking at you. But then they dig a little bit deeper and they find out, hey, this guy, you know, he has sex for money. And that's a kind of total anomaly in their head because you didn't fit the image. You weren't the grungy, skanky, drug obsessed hustler that, you know, was just working for a fix. You were actually a much more well-rounded, you know, real person. You had intellectual interests. You had musical interests. You had friends that had, you know, stable lifestyles that had what other people would call real careers. They were, you know, whether a movie producer or an internet, you know, guy or a tech guy or whatever they were.
Yeah.
So you were kind of an anomaly in that world because you didn't really fit the mold of how most people would picture somebody who had been, you know, posed naked on the cover of a gay magazine or been in gay porn or been paid regularly hundreds or even thousands of dollars at a time for having sex with other people. So, you know, you didn't really fit the generic mold of what people would envision as the, you know, the gay hustler.
Boy, I couldn't say anything more to that. I wish I would have recorded that. We could put it on a poster right here above the computer. you guessed it. I mean, I really didn't fit into all that. But a lot of that comes from, if people, you know, think of that, they didn't know my childhood. They didn't know what I went through. But I also had a talent. I could play, you know, not bragging. I'm saying this with the utmost humility. I could play Bach and Beethoven on the piano by ear when I was 4 and 5. Now, I had parents that, even with their despicable behavior, incest, you know, raping my sister, my mother having sex with me, all that stuff that they did, my father beating me and just hating everybody. Even they took notice of that and gave me a piano teacher. So I learned how to read classical music. And I think when I got into drug counseling, I had to study a lot of psychology. And I think one thing that saved me, or even though I didn't belong, like you said, I'm concurring with you that I was out of place in that world. I should have been in the music world completely, 100%. But I didn't have the confidence, because when you get beat up when you're 2 years old all the way up through your life, I mean, you lose confidence. You don't think you're very good. And yet that's one of the reasons why I stayed in that world. It was safe. It was safe for me. I was loved. I didn't have to worry about getting beat up. They also appreciated my talents. I did spend a lot, you know, half my time in the music industry. I mean, I did play with some famous artists and celebrities, but I never went as far as I should have. I mean, I have a lot of songs I've written, and some of them have been used, and some I've kept control of them all this time. And it may be a good time to release a couple along with the book, you know, so I'm considering that. I was able to play every instrument, you know, since I was a kid. I won all the Elton John contests in third grade, fourth grade in the elementary school. And it was fun, but then I'd have to go back home and get beat up. So, that, you know, it screwed me up. Put it this way. I would say that I have dissociative personality disorder. You know, I call myself a narcissist because I saw, when I picked up that book, the DSM-IV, I saw a lot of narcissism in me, you know, but I'm really not like a Trump or a complete narcissist. It's more like, you know, I split into two different people because being one person hurt too much. So I had to be a second person. And I'd say the narcissism is a coping mechanism. It's a coping mechanism onto how to deal with life. You either go out there I busted my eye. I'm like the bravado, all the bravado, and I put it out in the front. But you know, and people were intimidated by me. I could fight. You know, I went through all those years in a system, and I'll hit you before you hit me. But the bottom line is, inside, I'm terrified. There was a terror. You know, I'd get terrified. You know, I'd play piano bar left and right, and I'd do good, really well. But I'm that guy that focuses on the one person that didn't like it. You know, it's like, yeah, childhood shit.
So we talked about a number of bars that were kind of important to you back in the 80s there. And, but a couple that we didn't really get into, and I think you might want to have something to say about, are a couple of bars in Laguna. The Boom Boom is one of them. Tell us a little bit about your experience with the Boom Boom.
The Boom Boom Room. I was taken to the Boom Boom Room by my escort mentor, John Movido, who was Robbie Leonetti in the gay adult film world. He looked just like Robbie Benson. That's why he was called that. And he helped me navigate the world. And he took me down to Laguna and he said, there's this place called the Boom Boom Room. And all you got to do, the way you look, they'll let you in. You're 17. They'll let you in. All you got to do is stand there in the back and let somebody suck your dick and they'll give you $100, $200. I was like, really? And he's like, yeah. And he said, I do it all the time. So we went there and, you know, I didn't pay much attention to all the dancing and all that stuff going on. I just went right to the back, stood there. And, you know, when you're 17, 18 years old, you can come five times and I would make money every night that we were there. In fact, there were times when I didn't want to leave. I wanted to get a place in Laguna and just stay there. Because not only was I making money, but the Boom Boom Room really was a cool place to be. There was just a lot of dancing, a lot of nice people, a lot of good people. And it was famous. It was well known, very well known by not only people like me who were the hustlers, but a lot of the Johns, a lot of the people that were paying for it went there just for that. And all I had to do was stand against a wall. I mean, you know.
And to put that in perspective a little bit, you know, with the rate of inflation, $200 in 1981 or 82 is roughly equivalent to about $600 today.
Right.
So if you were making that three or four times in one day in, you know, the early 80s in Laguna, that's like $2,500. I mean, that's enough money to buy a car or...
That's how I got a car, yeah. Exactly.
I mean, in one day. So, you know, it was obviously for you a very, very lucrative field, and obviously not very strenuous work. It's not like you had to work on a construction site 12 hours a day. And
I had done that before that. And that was backbreaking. You know, I was making $12.88 an hour as a laborer on a construction site for Vons. And it broke my fucking back. I mean, I got fired for having forklift braces. I was, you know, I was a kid, but,
and there's no glory that comes with that. You have the paycheck. There's nobody there saying you're hot, you know, let me suck your dick. And then you're going, here's your $12. Go home.
Right. Right. But so even then, union had my back. I mean, you know, I didn't join a union, but,
You also had an experience in Laguna with a place called the Little Shrimp.
The Little Shrimp, yes. Little Shrimp was more of a politics bar. They were constantly being raided by the police. I was there with I can't even remember their names. Some of the people that were my surrogate fathers. I was there with them while they were discussing, you know, politics in Orange County. And the cops would bust in, and I think the Little Shrimp died in the 90s because of a disagreement between the owner and the manager. I don't know what happened, but it was more of a sit down conversational bar, and everybody loved it. It was a great one. There's one place that you just triggered something in my head that was in Laguna that I loved, and it was Ron's. I don't know if you remember that. I don't know if you ever heard of it, but Ron's. Ron's in Laguna was up there on par as far as restaurants and bars with anything Wolfgang Puck has ever put out, including Cut and all his best restaurants. Ron's was on a hill up in Laguna, and it was a gay restaurant. And oh my God, the food was incredible. I could play the piano there. I was just loved by the gay men. They had a bar there. I could make money there if I wanted to. But I was usually taken there by, you know, one of my surrogate fathers. And, but yeah, I, if you look up Ron's, I Googled it earlier. It still comes up, but I don't know what happened to it. But, it's like the Ruth's Chris or Mastro's of restaurants. It's top of the line. It was top of the line. And it was run by Ron, a gay man, ran the restaurant. And that was another place I made money, and another place that doesn't exist anymore. That's another one.
Oh, very, very cool. And I know you have a ton more stories from from Los Angeles, from New York City, from all kinds of places. And we'll address those in another segment, because I definitely want to hear those stories too. But right now I want to mention something. So we've mentioned during the course of the interview, your book.
Yes.
And for people who do not know, Doug's name while he was hustling on the streets of Long Beach in LA was Sean Myatt. And he wrote a book recently, kind of a memoir, tell-all story of his younger days up, it's upside down, Doug, of his younger days up to about age 30, I think.
Yeah. And
it's called Myatt, The Musings of a Narcissist, a Survivor Story. And we'll put a link to that at the end of the video, but it tells everything from, you know, childhood abuse to sexual abuse while in custody of state agencies and boys' homes, to coming out on the strip in Long Beach and building up his career and his contacts, some musical stories in there about working with different celebrity and not celebrity musicians. There's a lot of information in there. It's at times heartbreaking and at times uplifting. But it's definitely something that's available out there on Amazon and I think other sources. And we'll put some links to that at the end too. But what was that like? When did you decide you were going to write this book? How long after, you know, the 1981, 82 timeframe did you actually say, hey, I'm ready to write this?
No, I was just living life and trying to, you know, make my way through. I was really trying to get into the music industry any way I could. I mean, Billy Preston was the first person who allowed me to play bass with him on tour. So, you know, because I was good and all that. But I decided to write the book after a friend of mine, Neil, told me, you know, I was already 35, 36, 37, and Josh was 10 or 11 or 12, something like that. And he said, your fucking life is like the most dramatic thing I've ever heard. I mean, there's stories I haven't told that you know, a lot of people went through and didn't survive. And, you know, behind Astro Burgers and I mean, just a lot of stuff that I didn't include in the book that I could write another book about. It was like a nonstop dramatic, either sexual, crazy, just crazy stuff. Every day, all of the time. It slowed down when I raised my son, especially the first 5 years. But he told me, you should write a book. And I thought about it, and I thought, well, I do like to write songs, so I'll start writing a book. And I wanted to shout out to the world what happened to me as a child, because my family really is the worst, all of them. They're all the worst. When I started making a lot of money, and I made a lot of money, I mean, in the millions, I would help every one of them. Every one of them would take a check from me every month. And then when I talked to my aunt Kathy's her name, and I said one time, you know, you never visited me when I was in juvenile hall, you never came or nothing. And you know what she said to me? She said, I've heard this all before, Doug, while she's getting a $500 check every month. So I just cut them all off. I cut my mom off. I cut them all off, except my sister who's turned her life around. She actually bought a book and she told me, my God, Doug, you told the whole truth. Everything in there is the truth. And she gave me a story that I had forgotten about that was traumatic. You know, when they put me in a mental hospital and I was screaming and crying. I had forgotten all about that. Maybe I blocked it out. But yeah, there is a lot of universal pain in this book. I think a lot of people may be able to relate to it. I did when I started writing it in my late 30s, it was going to be about me, but then I changed my mind and I really wanted it to be for the boys that died early because nobody kept statistics of them. I remember Caesar died. He was 15 years old, dying on Broadway in Esperanza of AIDS. We didn't know it was AIDS and we didn't know what to do with his body. And then other boys that were out there, they gave up their lives so people could enjoy them in film and all that. And I had to listen to all the sick jokes, but these people, these kids, and were real people. And some of them had real talents. And I'll never forget one of my best friends, Paul Andrews, who I was in a boys' home with, coming up to me and coughing and saying, you know, you got to tell the guys out here that something's going on, you know, get them off here. Because I think this is bigger than just coughing. And I didn't know what he meant. And I said, yeah, you've been coughing a while. But that shows the beauty of some of these guys. You know, these gay kids cared about each other. And everybody wants to mock them. You know, and I just want to say, fuck you for mocking them. You know, they were my friends. And they were real living people. And, you know, not just the stars who died of AIDS. But there's thousands of these kids who died of AIDS and nobody cared. I mean, I had to bury Paul. And I had to pay for his burial. I paid for a few burials because his father was a minister and kicked him out of the house for dying of that faggot disease, you know. It was weird. It was a sad time. I didn't understand that kind of hate and prejudice. You know, he's your son. I mean, if my son was gay, I'd take him to the best gay bar in the world. Have fun. You know, it's like, I don't understand any of that. But, you know,
Doug, I really appreciate you taking the time to kind of take this little walk down memory lane and talk about some of your Long Beach experiences and your hustling days. And I'm really looking forward to the chance to do another segment, maybe yes, Los Angeles and West Hollywood, because you have so many stories to tell. But thank you so much for being on the show today. And good luck with your book. I'll put the link up at the end of the video. And that concludes another segment of the Gay Barchives podcast. You can find more podcasts at gabearchives.com/podcast. We also have more information about this podcast and links to the other podcasts we have completed. We hope you enjoy your trip down memory lane.